up here at KPFK's booth at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books on the campus of UCLA. In this first segment, we are dealing with a couple of folks, D.T. Max and Sean Carroll, who are on a panel together as soon as they leave here. And so both of them, that panel is about science. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at Caltech. He's a contributor to the physics blog Cosmic Variance. He's published in all sorts of scientific journals. He's the author of a graduate-level textbook called Space, Time, and Geometry, which I recommend you pick up. And that's on general relativity, but you knew that.
A little light reading.
Yeah, yeah. And his new book is on the arrow of time, and it's entitled From Eternity to Here. And it has a great picture of Deborah Carr and on the
exactly.
front and the beach and everything. It's really fabulous. But they're reversed.
Exactly. Moving backwards.
And the sea is going out. Yeah. And then D.T. Max, for the past 8 years, has reported mostly for the New Yorker and the New York Times on everything from the quagga, an extinct relative of the zebra that a South African taxidermist tried to breed back to life, to the president's speechwriters in the days after September 11th. His work has been anthologized in the Best American Science Writing 2006. He's the author of The Family That Couldn't Sleep, which is an investigation of a mysterious illness and a number of related illnesses. And he's working now, as I said, on a biography of David Foster Wallace. Welcome, D.T. Max.
Thank you.
And Sean Carroll.
Thanks.
Okay. First of all, let's just fill in, folks. This is a book festival, an author's festival. D.T., your book, The Family That Couldn't Sleep. If someone were saying, I've heard of this book,
right.
What's it about?
If somebody bumps into me at the festival, what do I tell them before they go off and get their cotton candy?
Exactly.
All right, this is a true story about a family in Italy who for 200 years have had a fatal insomnia. And this is an insomnia that comes on in their 50s. It's inherited. And the first symptom is that suddenly your eyes, your pupils become these tiny little pinpricks, and then you begin to sweat uncontrollably. And then you can't nap, and then you can't sleep well at night, and then you can't sleep at all.
Question.
Yeah, you don't have it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
The sweating and so on,
right.
and those things, they're all the time, not just at night when you're trying to sleep, they're just all the time?
Right. Basically what the disease turns out to be, and the disease has been a real treasure trove for researchers because it connects to more common diseases like Parkinson's, is turns out to be a disease called a prion disease. And in prion diseases, the prions are basically kind of little proteins that eat away at the brain if you have the infected version. And so these people have an inherited version of a disease where the brain basically begins to destroy itself. And the primary symptom of that is insomnia.
And how long will they last if it sets on in their 50s?
Basically, the question is, how long can you live without sleep?
Yeah.
And that's the question that the book in some ways tries to answer. And I think the answer is basically that this family can live for about a year and a half. Obviously, we're not talking about a very, very high quality of life, but before the disease eventually becomes so devastating that they, I think, actually mercifully pass away. I mean, it's a very, very difficult disease. But as I say, it's been a huge treasure trove for researchers looking at more common diseases as well.
And is that the treasure trove you described, is that partially because it's isolated in this one family, and so you can focus a lot, or is it just that it's related to so many other things?
I mean, I think there's two reasons. One, it's very rare to have a family that can trace its sort of genetic inheritance back so far. I mean, this for a researcher obviously sees the matter differently than the members of the family is an incredible bit of good luck.
And partially that's because they're not just a couple of folks who met each other in Chicago, but they're in a Venetian family,
exactly.
Of the aristocracy.
Right, it's a Venetian family, it's an Italian family. Italians, far more than Americans, tend to stay in the same place over time. But the reason it's a valuable disease, to speak of it from a research point of view, is basically because it turns out that a number of diseases that are more common, like Alzheimer's, involve the same process, which is basically proteins which misfold, and we don't have to get time for the science of that, but essentially we always thought of diseases being viruses and bacteria, but it turns out that it is possible for a protein to be infectious. At least that's the theory. Some of it worked on right here at UCLA.
Sean, your book that I joked about, From Eternity to Here, has gotten some wonderful reviews, and I've seen a lot of notice about it recently, because it seems that you're taking sort of impossible to understand concepts and making them slightly more possible.
That would be the idea, yeah. I mean, they never were impossible to understand. It was just formidable. And I think that, you know, the book is about some very big ideas with cosmology and physics and the multiverse. But it starts in the kitchen or in your, or, you know, when you're trying to go to sleep, as DT was just saying. Time is something that is absolutely indispensable to how we live our everyday lives. And in particular, time flows. There's a motion of time from the past to the future. And so when you start with this, and it's a true statement, and then you try to understand it, and you try to reconcile it with what you know of the laws of nature, and you hit puzzles. It's not clear. If you look at the fundamental, deep-down laws of physics, they don't tell any difference between the past and the future. But our everyday lives,
now, wait.
Too.
So what doesn't tell the difference are the laws of physics.
That's right.
So according to laws of physics, the present moment looks exactly like a million years ago?
Is that, no, according to the laws of physics, moving forward in time isn't any different than moving backward
okay,
in
got
time.
It.
So if you made a movie of, you know, breaking an egg and played it backwards, you would know. But if you made a movie of a pendulum going back and forth or the Earth going around the sun and played it backward, it would look fine. It's only in our complicated, messy world where there's a lot of different pieces moving that there begins to be this directionality, this arrow of time pointing from the past to the future. And it's absolutely that one underlying fact, that the past is different from the future, is responsible for all sorts of things, from breaking eggs to sleeping to aging to memory to metabolism to evolution. And ultimately, in the book, I talk about if you chase down where it comes from the Big Bang. It was all set up 13.7 billion years ago when the universe started.
Okay. Just because it's something everyone knows the term, some doubt it, those who believe that the Earth is actually only 6,000 or so years old, but most don't. But for someone who's been working at making this stuff understandable, what is the Big Bang?
That's a great question. The short answer is we don't know. It's a placeholder for where our knowledge of the universe gives out. But the slightly better answer is it's a moment about 13.7 billion years ago. The Earth is 4.5 billion years old, for some comparison. So we look out the universe now, and everything is moving apart from everything else. Galaxies in the universe. We live in a universe with 100 billion galaxies, with 100 billion stars per galaxy, and they're all moving apart. The universe is getting bigger. So if you imagine playing that movie backwards, in the past, everything was closer together. You take the movie all the way back, there was a moment when everything was on top of everything else. The whole universe was in one place, and that's the Big Bang.
So the Big Bang is a title for a moment,
or is it
an action?
It's a moment. It's the beginning
of the
universe.
See, but it's interesting. As a layman,
mm-hmm.
the expression Big Bang always sounded to me like the explosion from which things started.
That's right. That's because we have a terrible way of choosing names for things in science. And the phrase, the Big Bang, was a joke told by someone who didn't believe it. He says, those people with their cosmology and their relativity saying that the universe began with some Big Bang, and it caught on.
Oh, my God. And I bet that's not the only time that kind of thing happens.
Not at all.
Because it may be that the scientist who coins it, understands it, and so on, doesn't have the handle on phraseology that a critic or a writer might. What I'd love to do now, although I'm going to come back, is do either of you have any question for the other? You guys know more about...
I have a question for DT. So,
great. So this is Sean Carroll asking DT Max.
One of the great things about sleep, we all do it, we're familiar with it, and people wonder what it's for. Do we learn anything from studying things like this disease about what good it is to sleep? I mean, what is the benefit of being completely helpless for 8 hours a day?
I thank you for that question, and it's the question that I love to get. And if you'll feed me the question to you that you'd love to get, because I think I got to read your book first.
And
I very much want to, but you've hit on the most interesting and odd thing: a third of our lives sleep, and yet we do not know really why we need to sleep. So there are a couple of theories that have begun to gain sort of some traction, but I don't think any of them will answer the following objection. There was a famous sleep researcher named Alan Rechtschaffen who said that if sleep doesn't serve some absolutely vital purpose, it's the greatest mistake nature ever made. By which he meant 8 hours without eating, without collecting food, without any of the basic things that we do for evolutionary advantage. So why do we sleep? Well, short answers, we really still don't know. Some small answers, it appears, through some very clever studies, that we sleep in some part to consolidate our memories. Now, when I say that, I don't necessarily mean that we sleep in order to remember that, you know, that booth 213 is where we have to go. We're actually talking about something on a neuronal level. So it may be that by shutting down a lot of the bodily, the larger bodily processes, we can sort of use more energy in order to establish neuronal connections, or others think eliminate unnecessary neuronal connections. And that has some advantage, that's useful to all of us. Now, personally, I don't really explain the commitment of one-third of our lives to a certain act. It's also possible, anyone who looks at evolution will know, that it's possible that that sleep is actually some sort of accidental byproduct of something that we actually do need. But I don't think we know. I don't think a long time. I think we all intuitively know we have to sleep. And none of us figure out why, but you know, you try going without it, and obviously certain mental processes are highly impaired. I think sleeping 3 hours a night for two nights in a row, is, if you try to drive after, is equivalent to being legally over the limit. I mean, lack of sleep is basically an intoxicant. I'd like to return the favor. So, and Terry, if you can help, or if you want to ask yourself a question, because I would like to know more.
I'm not going to bail you out here. Okay. What is it you want to know about time or the universe? Those are the two things I'm supposed to understand.
You know, I got to be honest. It reminds me of that Woody Allen movie where he's the little boy
in Brooklyn.
Yeah, in Brooklyn. Which movie
it's
is
the
it?
The start of Annie Hall.
Hall, and he says, you know, why? You know, it's like, well, why are you behaving that way? Why are you moping around? And he says, the universe is expanding, and then his mother says, but is that your business?
Brooklyn is not expanding.
Right,
he says,
right,
yes,
right.
No, it's funny. As you said it, I saw that image, and I'll bet that's true of millions.
I'll throw you a question that's so simple it's going to give you plenty of room to maneuver, which is, why is it that time is something which we perceive is so evident and so unidirectional, but when you actually begin to read about time or to think about time in the sophisticated way that you're able to do, why does it suddenly become exactly the opposite? And this is a question I could have asked you 50 years ago had we been old enough, but see what you can do with that.
The question you just asked is almost a direct quote from St. Augustine. He asked this question in like 400 AD. So
there's a lot of time.
There's a quote from him in my book that says, you know, as long as you don't ask me what time is, I understand it. But once you want the definition, I'm at a loss. And we're still there. And I think what I try to emphasize is there's a tremendous amount about time that we do understand. Einstein gave us a tremendous handle on how space and time play together and how that's related to gravity. And we understand a lot about how clocks work, how we measure time. The mysteries come in when we talk about the fact that time flows, that it has a direction. And even that we understand a lot about. It goes back to the hero, in some sense, a 19th century Austrian physicist who explained to us entropy and the fact that things get more disorganized through time. You know, entropy increases, the universe goes from being highly organized, very, very precise, to a mess. Everything is scattered all over the place. And the amazing thing that we're still trying to work out, well, there's two amazing things. One is that one process, entropy increasing, the universe becoming messier, getting sloppier, more disorganized, is behind every single difference between the past and the future. The fact that you grow older, the fact that you remember the past and not the future, the fact that you think you can cause things in the future, but you can't cause things in the past.
Is all because of entropy?
It's all because
How so?
Of entropy.
And for people again, entropy, second law of thermodynamics.
That's right. Entropy is just a way of thinking about how messy things are. High entropy, very, very messy. If you have a stack of papers on your desk and it's neatly arranged
and the wind blows,
that's low entropy. If you scatter them, wind blows, whatever, the entropy has gone up. So the whole history of the universe is entropy going up. And we're really just at the beginning of it. You know, we're a 13 billion year old universe. That sounds old. But we have more than a Google years to go. You know, the good old fashioned sense of the word Google with a 10 to the 100 power. You know, we have a very, very long time before the universe
so Woody
comes out
was,
of steam.
Woody was actually alarmed before he had to be.
Yeah, exactly. No.
Now he should worry.
And that's another good question. You know, one of the features of the history of our studies of the universe is that we become a smaller and smaller part, okay? Ever since Copernicus said that, no, actually, we're not at the middle, okay? And then Newton and Galileo says there's no absolute frames of reference. And then Hubble says it's not just our galaxy. We're one of 100 billion galaxies. And in my book, and a lot of other people, modern cosmologists right now, are saying it's not even just our universe. Our universe is part of a much bigger thing. We're trying to explain why the early universe was so organized. And my analogy is, you know, an egg is more organized than an omelet, right? It's more low entropy, more precisely arranged. But you're not surprised when you find an egg in your refrigerator, and that's because it came from a chicken. It's not alone in the universe. And so maybe our universe came out of something bigger, a universal chicken that gave birth to our universe in a very precise form.
It's so funny. When I hear these kinds of conversations, I always think of being maybe a sophomore in high school.
Dude, or have you ever really thought about time?
Or a sophomore in college. Yes. I'm not sure which sophomoric is more real. But when you sit around late at night and procrastinate for whatever you're supposed to be doing by these kinds of questions, and it's just wild. Let me ask.
But it's my job.
Very good. So you took that. Yes. You took that and said, "I'm going to actually get paid for this," which is there's your achievement.
The Universal Chicken. That was the title of your book that almost made it in.
Yeah, I know. I had a good title.
Are there indigenous people who sense time differently? And if so, why? Do people think so?
Yeah, this is the question that I always get, but unlike your question, I don't know the answer to this one. So,
it's a great question.
As a physicist, as a scientist, I understand that we keep track of time through clocks. Clocks are just things that do the same thing over and over again. The first clocks were just the stars and the sun moving through the sky. It was very predictable and repetitive, and a wristwatch is very predictable and repetitive. And we feel time passing because we have clocks inside our bodies. We have our pulse, our heartbeat, the rhythm of our breathing, our central nervous system. And the problem is that we are not as good at being a clock as a quartz watch or a very precise pendulum would be. So our experience of time is affected by our environment, how tired we are, how much sleep we've had, you know, whether we've had coffee, whether we're in love, whether we're bored. And there's a whole million things that we should study and are being studied by people who are much more involved in this than I am that are learning fascinating things about how the brain processes time.
So, in other words, do scientists not know whether there are indigenous tribes that experience time differently?
I think that at my level of knowledge, I would not be at all surprised if there were indigenous tribes, because that's different human beings.
I was going for it also because of this unfolding that you talked about of how our place gets smaller, we learn, or so on. So if you go back to people who are contemporaneous with us, but don't know all that,
right,
and they're just
don't have clocks.
All they have to, and don't have clocks.
Yeah.
Which are sort of anti-entropy machines.
My guess, I'd be interested what Sean says about this, is that, you know, time is an internal concept to humans. I mean, we have natural rhythms, for instance, menstruation. There's day and night, and
the cycles of the moon.
And so I would think that although there might be, I mean, think the way indigenous tribes sleep that are often made much of it, but I would think that time, although not necessarily the exact measurement of time, would be something that we can comfortably assume hominids had.
I wanted to ask you a couple of questions, DT, about sleep. One was, in college at one point, I remember, it was partially an experiment, it was partially desperation, but I slept an hour in the morning, and then I had my job I had to go to. And in the afternoon, I slept an hour, and then I got up and I studied and I worked, and then around midnight, I slept an hour. And I did this for 3 weeks.
You slept 3 hours a day for three weeks.
And never in blocks of more than an hour.
Youth.
Yes.
I think that's... I hope you didn't have a driver's license.
I didn't.
I'll tell you, there's some wonderful things about sleep that are really interesting. One is and this goes exactly to the point you're making. Oddly enough, people overestimate their ability to adjust to a lack of sleep. And this is actually one of the more lethal things about people who, for instance, drive with too little sleep. But unlike a lot of other bodily processes, we're always thinking that we're recovering from it at a level that's adequate for our needs. So I mean, eventually, obviously, everybody will fall asleep. It's what's called a homeostatic process. But now, how over that period of time you could actually sleep 3 hours. I mean, the world's record, and I do think this speaks to you. There was a fellow out in, he was under the care, I think, of the Stanford Sleep Center at the time. A teenager who I think went, 11 days, 12 days, 14 days without sleep at all, subsisting, as I remembered, entirely on Twinkies and pinball. Now, I may have that confused with Harvey Milk, but it's something like that. He certainly was junk food and pinball, that part I'm sure of. And so it is possible to function for fairly long periods of time on some level.
And by the way, I was teaching school every day.
You were teaching.
That was my job.
Well,
now that
explains
I think about it.
I thought you were trying to learn.
I was teaching from 8 to 2 and then doing my... That's why I was desperate situation.
May I ask what you were teaching?
I was teaching junior high.
But science or English or...
Math and English.
No, I don't see an easy explanation on this.
Okay.
You may be an unusual individual, but I challenge you to try it today now that you're in your 30s. Late 30s.
Late 30s. That's very
well,
sweet.
Well, time, reversible.
Another one, because I think when people hear the word prion, this is a question for DT Max. Prion is something which I think most people, if they weren't aware of, became aware of. These days of mad cow disease that was so, the threat of all threats before terrorists hit or something.
So basically the fatal familial insomnia, which is the disease that the family in my book suffers from, is called a prion disease. And there are also prion diseases which are conveyed infectiously. Mad cow disease, which as it sounds is a disease of cattle, but also a disease which can pass on to humans when they ingest the meat of diseased cattle, is the best known prion disease that we have. The short answer is because prion diseases are so complicated and mischievous, and because they can live in tissue for so long without showing symptoms, we really don't know still whether there is a high risk of a substantial mad cow infection in the U.S. population. We know what happened in Europe in the late 80s, early 90s, a massive infection with billions of doses of mad cow disease consumed primarily by British meat eaters, with resulting in a couple of hundred deaths. If I was guessing, and this would just be a guess, I would say that there is probably a certain amount of mad cow disease in our cattle population that's probably not caught, but that it's also probably not... I don't think we're missing... Some people theorize that a lot of the sort of rise in Alzheimer's disease in our country is actually a covert form of mad cow disease ingested by humans. I don't think that there's convincing evidence for that, although I certainly would love to see more studies.
To just ask you both what you're working on now. I've said, DT, in your case, that you're working on a biography of David Foster Wallace. You wrote a very long article on him, and was that the seed of this?
That's the seed of it. I should just back this up. But David Foster Wallace, in the context of this interview, sounds like a scientist.
Right.
Probably a 19th century a friend of Darwin, but actually David Foster Wallace was a tremendously talented author who committed suicide at the end of 2008. He was the author of Infinite Jest, and he had suffered from a very long and profound depression. So that did come from the New Yorker piece, and it's a book that I'm working on that I'll probably finish sometime at the end of this year.
Okay. And Sean, what are you working on besides promoting this one or probably catching up with whatever craziness you went to get it out?
Yeah, no, I'm doing my real work. I'm actually doing research. We're thinking about dark matter, dark energy, what makes up the universe, where the universe came from, the first millisecond of the universe's history, and how to test it, how to connect it with observations we can make today.
By the way, that was going to be my question, is when you say we're working on that, does that mean a bunch of smart folks in a room talking, or is there what is the work that one does?
Yeah, well, it's very, very specialized. So my work is I go to Starbucks and I sit down with a pencil and paper and some equations, right? But hopefully those equations eventually make a prediction that the real work starts where people build a machine, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, or the telescopes that NASA puts up into space, and we're trying, the technological improvements that have happened over the last couple decades have absolutely revolutionized our understanding of the universe. And so it's a great time to be alive and to be thinking about all this thing.
Because in the old days you could speculate all you wanted and come up with crazy ideas, but you couldn't test them very well.
Something happened in the last 20 years when we really began to be able to probe the universe in a much more thorough way and understand some of its more subtle hints. We've detected and are analyzing the leftover radiation from the Big Bang, and it's telling us a lot of stories.
Thank you, DT Max.
Thank
Again,
you.
His book is The Family That Couldn't Sleep. Sean Carroll, and his book is From Eternity to Here.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Okay.